not being able to get to the quarterback was never much of a problem for the defensive front. That is no longer the case. Changes to the rules have opened up the passing game, and defenses need to be creative in the ways they pressure the passer to make him throw before he wants to. That means being smarter about the kind of blitzes sent at opponents. When offensive coordinators call a play that results in a touchdown or a long game, we compliment the great call. When a defensive coordinator calls a blitz that sacks the quarterback, we often just move on to the next down. But the particular details and timing of the call deserve our praise too. Specific blitzes attack weaknesses in protection, and that means defenses have to understand what those protections are trying to do and when the best time to attack them would be. The thing is, most of the time coaches don't have a good enough grasp of those particulars, and so they can't be strategic about their blitz calls. They just blindly send as many guys at the quarterback as they can and hope for the best. In that sense, Lombardi was right. Random blitzes are a sign of weakness, but well-designed strategic blitzes most definitely are not. Al Davis was also not a big believer in total pressure. He saw blitzing the same way Lombardi did, as an admission of some inadequacy. In fact, he had a steadfast edict for all his defensive coordinators: never leave the middle of the field open. And that contained an implicit corollary: no all-out pressures. It was Raider law. That's not to say that Davis forbade his defense to blitz. They just had to be sure to leave the free safety in the middle of the field when they did. Davis had reasons for his mandate, particularly his second rule of defense: no big plays. He felt a man in the middle of the field was an important last line of defense against big plays. Not surprisingly, though, his no all-out blitz decree handcuffed his defensive coaches and drove them all crazy. To them, it felt like an impossible to overcome handicap. Every Raiders opponent knew of Davis's no all-out blitz rule, and that meant they didn't need to prepare for that type of pressure. In 1955, the legendary Paul Brown predicted that as quarterbacks become more mobile and accurate, sending an extra man to pressure the passer would become a necessary evil. Writing for Collier's Magazine, Brown stated, "The great quarterback in future years will have to run as well as pass to survive pro lines, which seem to get rougher and faster every season. The defense places a greater emphasis on rushing the passer. The new development in pro football, therefore, will have to be the running quarterback." The guy knew what he was talking about. But his crystal ball certainty depended on a game in which the value of defensive linemen never wavered. To this day, there is nothing more powerful than a defense that can bring adequate pressure with a four-man front. When you can create pressure with just four players, that means you can flood the passing zones with the remaining seven defenders, which makes a quarterback feel like he's facing a 13-man defense. It's such a powerful advantage that it tends to create nickname-worthy defenses such as the Fearsome Foursome of the Los Angeles Rams, the Steel Curtain in Pittsburgh, and Dallas's Doomsday defense. Today, though, the economics of the game, salary cap and free agency, make it hard to afford four top-flight rushers on one roster, and that's why blitzing has become a difference maker. Only now the goal of blitz pressure isn't to sack the quarterback, it's to make him throw the ball prematurely and under duress. Forcing a quarterback to throw the ball hot is a huge win for the defense, especially on third down, because it will force a receiver to catch the ball short of the sticks and get the defense off the field. In today's pass-first football, pressure matters more than sacks do, as long as it's strategic. What does it mean to be strategic with pressure? Simply put, it means to run the blitz that will attack the pass protection most effectively and give you the greatest chance to get a defender to the passer unblocked. Of course, that's not simple at all, and it begins with understanding how the offense intends to protect the passer. What good is a pass rush stunt blitz, after all, if the defensive end who's looping runs into an offensive tackle tight end double team block that is just waiting for him? On TV, you can hear the sideline microphones pick up a quarterback in passing situations screaming at his line, making sure they know where the mic backer is. That's because most pass protections designate a specific player, the running back, or one of the linemen to block the blitzer. The point out isolates the focal point of the defense, and all blocking schemes and responsibilities stem from that identification. Who picks up the blitz changes with the protection scheme, keeping the defense from knowing who it needs to worry about. For example, whether or not the tight end is participating in protection too. All this means is that the defense has a lot to decipher before it can choose a blitz with confidence. And choosing the correct blitz is only half of it. The defense needs to call it at a time that maximizes its chance of success. Play callers never get enough credit for making the correct call on the correct down on either side of the ball. Knowing when is a product of lots of film study. One way to be strategic with pressure is to save something for the second half of the game. In Cleveland, we once faced a team whose offensive line coach wasn't all that adept at in-game adjustments. The line coach was a former player, a good old boy, and the players fought hard for him, but he was not the quickest thinker. During the week, when he had time to review blitzes on film and work the problem in his own time, he figured out how to have his team ready for Sunday. But during a game, he was at a disadvantage, so Belichick saved some calls for critical moments later in the game when the guy had no time to whip up a counter. Bill Walsh loved putting all-out pressure on the quarterback, but mostly because it was a sign his game plan had gone well. He counted on his team getting a lead that would force opponents into playing catch-up through the air, leaving them vulnerable to defensive pressure. During my first year in the league, Fred Dean, our best pass rusher, held out for more money. Ray Rhodes, the secondary coach, and one of my early defensive teachers kept saying that we needed Dean back in the lineup to get interceptions. No, the 230-pound future Hall of Famer wasn't being switched to safety, although I would have liked to see that. Ray Bob, that was Rhodes' nickname, explained that although Dean's sacks were important, they weren't nearly as disruptive as the constant pressure he brought even when he didn't get to the quarterback. Time your blitzes for maximum impact while keeping a quarterback under constant pressure, and sooner or later, he'll crack. 9. Eliminate four-point plays. All third downs are not alike. A third down when you're backed up in your own territory is more important than a third down at midfield, because if you fail to convert, your opponent will have excellent field position. The leg strength of most of today's place kickers means there is a possibility of putting up points without the offense having to move the ball much. In fact, analytics will tell you that the outcome of a third down in the red zone can swing the score by 4 points, and you don't have to be a math whiz to see how. If a team holds an opponent on third down in the red zone, it takes the prospect of a touchdown largely off the table, leaving the offense to settle for 3, a difference of 4 points. That's huge. Most NFL games are decided by a lot less than 4 points, yet most teams defend all third downs the same way. The high red zone begins at the 30-yard line, the border at which the field goal seems likely for today's kickers. From there, offenses are attacking on what is essentially a 40-yard field, 30-yard plus 10 yards of the end zone. This smaller field tends to limit the number of offensive plays a team can call, because you cannot stretch the defense or clear out zones, and that in turn shrinks the windows a quarterback can throw into and forces him to elevate his accuracy. A smaller field favors the defense, less ground to defend, especially if it tackles well and doesn't allow yards after the catch or contact. Playing defense in the middle of the regular field means having to defend the length and the width, whereas a defense in the red zone gets to focus more on the width than on the length. A throw to the back of the end zone has to be perfect. A receiver doesn't have room to run under the catch. The back line is a defensive coach's accomplice. Therefore, the trend today in the NFL is for teams to play more zone in the red zone, drop 8 men into coverage, and let the offense wear itself out looking for a knockout punch. It's like the Muhammad Ali tactic. You know, the rope-a-dope he used against George Foreman and Zaire. Force them to take small, harmless gains in the red zone. Belichick often told his defense, and they will get impatient and make a mistake. Then we counterpunch. In 1991, Belichick transformed the Browns' defense from one of the worst in the league to one in its top half with a slight talent improvement, but a much greater emphasis on red zone third down execution. By 1994, Belichick realized that four-point plays, stopping opponents on third down in the red zone and preventing field goals from turning into touchdowns, often came down to keeping a quarterback in the pocket. Quarterback movement is a killer for a third down defense because once the guy gets out of the pocket, all hell breaks loose. Think back to when you played touch football in the backyard. If you are covering a receiver, once the pass rusher yells his fifth Mississippi, the play becomes something else entirely. The quarterback scrambles, the receivers break their routes to get open, and chaos reigns. In the NFL, because teams often use eight men in coverage, that chaos can be epic. Zones break down into man-to-man. Defenders have to chase down a scrambling quarterback, and holes open everywhere. In a four-point play situation, the goal is not to let the quarterback break the pocket, and that demands that the defensive linemen attack as they would, say a field goal down the middle and always in front of the passer, keeping his sight lines narrow and his escape routes few. If the defense can build an umbrella around the quarterback, he cannot escape. Keeping a quarterback from running is not luck. It's plant. Too many linemen run up the field using swim moves to get by the offensive linemen, creating space between themselves and other defensive attackers. But that space is an escape route for the quarterback. When the quarterback, afforded space, throws a touchdown from outside the pocket, the lineman walks off the field telling everyone, "I almost had him." Almost don't make it onto the stat sheet for a reason. This is why in Belichick's scheme, the defensive ends don't have nearly as much freedom as they would like at any part of the field, but especially in the red zone. In fact, ends who arrive in New England after playing for other teams have been known to complain about not being allowed to attack. But they learn soon enough that this kind of rush creates more problems than solutions. Compounding the drama, the battleground is at its most intense on third down because the offense knows it needs to succeed to keep the ball and thus will do whatever it takes to extend the play. Most quarterbacks run only when it matters, and red zone third downs matter most, particularly in a situation when the difference can be 4 points and probably the game. Letting a quarterback convert a third down in the red zone with his feet absolutely breaks a defense's back. In Super Bowl 49, Russell Wilson presented a unique problem that required a foolproof rush plan for the Patriots. Stopping Seattle on offense was mainly about stopping Wilson from moving around in the pocket. We were more worried about his feet than about his arm, and more worried about him in the red zone than in the middle of the field. Only two Seahawks had more than one rushing touchdown that season: Marshawn Lynch, the star running back, who had 13, and Wilson, who had 6. Stopping Lynch from running the ball in the red zone would be difficult, but at least we knew what he would do: run. Wilson, in contrast, could feign like he was going to run and then throw a pass. Wilson isn't tall. Forget what the program says. He's slightly under 6 feet, so he has a hard time seeing over the lineman. That means he needs to move left or right to find windows in the rush that afford him a view down the field. He does this with great success. His hit chart, a plotting of where he throws from, indicates that he is actually better when defensive pressure forces him from the pocket. If you want to handle Wilson, you better know what you want to accomplish with your pass rush. To use a basketball metaphor, in Super Bowl 49, the Patriots' rush plan was to stop Wilson by getting their defensive linemen in the paint or within 1 yard of and directly in front of the quarterback. That prevented him from stepping forward and seeing down the field. All quarterbacks hate dealing with someone in their face. They can deal with pass rushers running at them from the sides because they have room to step up and away. At the same time, from the defense's standpoint, the worst place for any defender to be is 2 yards past the quarterback. You just rushed yourself right out of the play. Now it's 10 on 11. Against Wilson, Belichick had his defensive ends play down the middle. inside the offensive tackles, forcing the quarterback to step into the paint where our defensive tackles were waiting. Wilson finished the Super Bowl with just 12 completions, a manageable 39 yards rushing, and 0 4-point plays. 10. Games are won or lost in the final 4 minutes of the first half. To this day, when the Patriots win a coin toss, they often defer possession to the second half. The choice goes against conventional wisdom and usually is dismissed as nothing more than a Belichick quirk, but in fact, it's a pretty ingenious tactical maneuver. All those years of facing Peyton Manning taught Belichick a great deal. But most specifically, they taught him that the best plan on defense is to keep the offense on the bench. Forget blitzes, timing, and defensive disguises. The simple truth is that Manning was never less dangerous than when he was standing next to his coach, Tony Dungy. Over time, Belichick actually built an entire game management theory around this simple realization. If the Patriots could manage a drive at the end of the first half and another at the beginning of the second half that would keep the opposing offense off the field for almost an hour of real time. For a guy like Manning, that's an eternity. No offense, no points, no plays, no rhythm. When Manning does finally get back in the game, he and his offense have lost their edge. Beyond that, Belichick's tactic usually tips the number of total possessions in the Patriots' favor. In chess, the player with the white pieces goes first, and that extra move often gives him or her a slightly better chance to win the game. Belichick's coin toss trick does the same thing in football, in which both teams usually end up with the same number of possessions, 12. On the road, there's a benefit to deferring after winning the toss. It outlasts the crowd. This is Belichick's genius in a nutshell. He's taking something simple as a coin toss, something 99% of the coaches don't even think about, and found a way to extract considerable extra value from it. At the start of the game, home fans are riled and loud. An away team that elects to receive has to deal with the crowd at its most rested and clear-throated. It's a recipe for going three and out without even being able to hear the play calls. In other words, a precious series of downs has been squandered. At the start of the second half, though, the stadium has a different feel. Fans are still in the bathroom or on the concession lines, and the stands are half empty. It's certainly not as intimidating as it is at the beginning. Visitors who have deferred receiving the kickoff don't have to contend with a wall of noise and thus are better able to get into a rhythm before the fans are back in their seats. But the thing is that Belichick's tactic pays off only if the receiving team in the second half ends the first half with the ball. Too few teams play defense in the final minutes of the half with that in mind. How often have you cursed your favorite team when it goes into its prevent defense willing to sacrifice yards for points as the half winds down? Better question, how often have those curses turn into murderous rage when those meaningless yards turn into very real points? Far too often, right? Well, that's because the best 4 minute defense is not a prevent defense. It's a defense that fights to get the ball back for the offense. To do that, defenses need to use a weapon most people see only as an offensive advantage, timeouts. When Belichick deploys the tactic, it doubles as a disruptive influence as well. Teams that play the Patriots know that if they don't run the clock out and New England gets the ball back with more than a few seconds on the clock, the Patriots are capable of cashing in because no one runs the hurry up better and their kicker can hit from the parking lot. In basketball, coaches talk all the time about closing out quarters, but in football, the concept doesn't garner much attention. Except for Belichick, who sees it as an opportunity to take over the game. For starters, by the time there's 4 minutes left in the half, he expects his defense to know the offense's game plan inside and out. If they don't, he's there to remind them. Over the headsets, Belichick will be saying things like, "This is a Landry game," when the Patriots are playing the Dolphins, and he suspects that wide receiver Jarvis Landry will be the focal point. The ends of the halves are when those talented players rear their heads. For another thing, he knows that most offenses wait to take advantage of the way teams simplify their defensive calls in two-minute drills. He, of course, does the opposite. Meanwhile, at the end of the half, offense is looking to move downfield quickly, think pass first and foremost. And when offense becomes one-dimensional, it's advantage defense. When Belichick tells his team that games are won and lost in the final 4 minutes, and trust me, he does that a lot, he often means the first half more than the second. 11. If you're not talking, you're not winning. Once in New England, Belichick ripped all the numbers off the preseason practice jerseys. Everyone thought it was intended to confuse the media and other onlookers, but really, it was to force the Patriots defenders to learn one another's names and get used to talking during the play. Belichick always said that if you want to know how well a defense is working, just listen. Defenses succeed only if the players know the scheme. But they really thrive when the players are talking to one another on the field. When it comes to adjustments, reads, and coverages, everybody needs to be on the same page in the lead-up and in the moment. Belichick's jersey trick didn't always work, though. You'd be surprised how many players, even great ones, would rather just do their thing and not worry about anything or anyone else. Darrell Revis was one of the best corners I've ever seen close up. He had fantastic awareness and instincts, and he could jam at the line to disrupt the timing of a pass as well as anyone. Quick feet, balance, the ability to play the ball, he had it all. Each week, Revis would study his assignment and then go out and shut down the best receiver on the other side. For most of his career, his focus was on one man and one man only. He didn't worry about what the rest of his teammates on defense were trying to do. When he came to New England in 2014, though, he had to learn to communicate with our other new corner, Brandon Browner. Big and physical, Browner wasn't as gifted as Revis, but he was a force on and off the field. One day in practice before a game against Peyton Manning and the Broncos, Revis went radio silent again in the defensive backfield, and the scout team hit them for a big play. That's not supposed to happen, and you could sense the tension from across the field. Revis was worried only about his own assignment, not about helping the rest of the unit, and as practice wore on, the tension between Revis and Browner escalated. When it finally boiled over, Browner flattened Revis with a massive roundhouse right to the temple. Revis got up and the two continued to fight. I mean really fight. This wasn't like linemen pawing at each other in training camp. This was a bar brawl, one of the most brutal I've seen on a practice field. It went on until the coaches and players separated them. Both guys were sent off the field. Belichick does not tolerate fighting, but sometimes he appreciates it. Revis might have been a better player, but Browner was the team leader, and the leader had spoken, albeit with his fist. And the message was heard. For the rest of the season, Revis was one of the chattiest defenders in the entire NFL. Some lessons about playing defense are more painful than others. Chapter 7. Game Planning. Preparing to Improvise. Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Mike Tyson. They will be confident riding high after a win. That's what Belichick told the Patriots players and staff who gathered in the team meeting room in Foxborough 2 days before the new year. In 2014, we earned the top seed in the AFC and a bye in the wild card playoffs, which left us in the strange position of preparing for a game without knowing who our opponent would be. But that didn't stop Belichick, the most experienced and successful playoff coach in NFL history, 26-10 lifetime, from putting his game plan into action. First things first, he wanted us to make sure we understood exactly what lay ahead, whoever our opponent would be. They'll have the momentum, so we have to be ready to play, he continued. We need to bring a great attitude and great energy. We need to be communicating and functioning as a complete team. There is a delicate balance to a bye week. You need to give the players a chance to rest and recharge while making sure they are properly focused for the next game. No one is better at this part of the game than Belichick. It's just a fact. When he gets into postseason, he wins. Only twice during his long career has he failed to win at least one game in the playoffs. That was in the back-to-back seasons of 2009 and 2010, a rare downturn that Belichick responded to by leading the Patriots to the Super Bowl, where they lost to the Giants, but still the next year. Believe me, the ghost of squandered postseasons will forever haunt this coach's dreams, spurring his unparalleled postseason preparation until the day he retires. Losses take a toll on any coach, but for Belichick, who is constantly asking what more he could have done, the toll is extreme. He never blames the players, instead pointing a finger at himself for not preparing them to win. There are members of the 2011 team, in fact, who still become emotional when recalling a broken and teary-eyed Belichick apologizing to everyone in the locker room after losing to the Giants. Those rare playoff losses haunt Belichick and push him to another level of intensity when the postseason begins. You can sense the change in his demeanor and delivery when the calendar flips to January. So despite the impending time off, he had a captive audience in that meeting room. Everyone listened intently, afraid of being caught flat-footed by one of the signature gotcha questions with which Belichick peppers his meetings. When he calls on you and you don't know the answer, he doesn't get loud or berate you. He does something way more humiliating. He simply ghosts you and moves on to someone else, most of the time anyway. When veteran linebacker Rob Ninkovich was quoted in the paper saying that the defense needed to handle screenplays better, Belichick asked him in one of the next meetings how we should go about doing that. Rob had no answers and sank into his seat. After that, every time the subject came up, Belichick would turn to the linebacker and quip, "So, Rob, you have strong opinions on screens. What do you think?" The team would laugh, to themselves, of course. Point made, and made, and made again. As he addressed the team during the 2014 bye week, Belichick warned about becoming complacent. He didn't want his team falling for the common postseason wisdom that playing at home is as good as a victory. Playing well with precise execution and avoiding mistakes will determine the winner, he reminded the players, not where the game is played. He then made it clear that the holidays could not be a priority. He wanted his team focused on nothing but being the best they could be when next they hit the turf. "We can celebrate the new year some other time," he said while staring right at Rob Gronkowski, a tight end known for his enthusiasm for partying. "Put everything in a back drawer for now. Focus on preparation. Nothing else matters." Playoff football is a completely different animal from regular season football. In the single elimination playoffs, games are lost far more often than they are won. Mental mistakes, turnovers, and abandonment of fundamentals, these problems are hard to overcome in the regular season and nearly impossible to survive in the no wiggle room scenario of the playoffs. There's a huge responsibility on players to have their best week of preparation and even more pressure on coaching staffs to create and implement the perfect game plan. Even though he's gotten more playoff experience than anyone in NFL history, Belichick will be the first to tell you that experience is not preparation. Having previously participated in a playoff game means nothing. Conversely, he told the team, having no prior postseason reps does not necessarily preclude immediate success. Belichick then recounted the story of Hall of Fame linebacker Lawrence Taylor's first playoff game in 1981. Taylor dominated the Philadelphia Eagles for 60 minutes, playing like he'd been there before because Belichick noted he had spent the week practicing as if he wanted to be there. That's what he expected us to do. "We were the number one seed, and so we would play the lowest remaining seed. Of the three possibilities, the Baltimore Ravens, the Cincinnati Bengals, and the Indianapolis Colts, we were most concerned about the Ravens. Going by wins and losses, they were the weakest team in the playoffs, but they always gave us a hard time. In fact, in one of the years New England's failed to advance beyond the first weekend of the playoffs, it was the Ravens who sent them home with a 33-14 thumping. Until we knew for sure, we would train our attention on the Ravens." In the meeting, Belichick gave the players their practice schedule for the week. Later in the day, he gave his staff their marching orders. But long before that, he had given me my postseason assignment, a complete analysis of the Patriots' previous playoff performances due the day after Christmas. During the NFL season, there are no breaks. Luckily, my wife, Millie, always understood the time requirements of my job. As long as we had an opportunity to spend a little time with Santa as a family, she never objected when I inevitably had to head back to work. With home field advantage locked up, I started my research a few weeks earlier, and despite the time away from home, I was having a lot of fun with this project. The first thing I learned was that Belichick's playoff game planning is informed by three things. One, what his team does well. These things will require time to hone, but not in-depth work. Two, what it doesn't do well. These things will be the focus of practice. And three, what he thinks it will take to win the playoffs in a particular year. The thick document I presented to him addressed each of these categories as they related to the 2014 team. One of the many things I loved about working for Belichick is that I never had to hold back. All he wanted was the truth, whatever it was. With Belichick, every interaction is about trying to win and get better. Bring him a way to do either, and you get his full attention. In fact, until I handed him my self-scouting memo, he had no preconceived ideas about how to approach this particular postseason. After reading it, he began to set a course over the next 2 weeks. The data I had uncovered meant that regardless of the opponent, the Patriots would need to focus their effort on three areas: red zone, third and short, and the kicking game. Before we sent the players away for a few precious days off prior to our first playoff game, we conducted one practice at our stadium on Thursday. It was a scrimmage to go over all the areas in my memo. Belichick usually reserves competitive inter-squad scrimmages for the summer as a way to get a feel for the lesser-known players trying to make the team. But in this case, Belichick thought a postseason blue and white affair would be a good way to refocus everyone on the things that mattered most, in particular, those third and short situations. Third and short is a unique problem for the defense, in part because both the run and pass are viable options. Belichick's theme all week was that at this time of the year, an entire season can be lost on one play, and so players have to be prepared at every moment for every possibility. On days like this, the field is an extension of Belichick's classroom, with each scenario analyzed and made actionable. Our goal was clear: don't squander any opportunity. We also worked on ways to create such opportunities by inserting a few trick plays into the game plan. The first was a wide receiver pass from Julian Edelman, a college quarterback, to Danny Amendola. In week four, we actually called it against Kansas City, but the Chiefs seemed to sense what was coming, so Brady threw the ball to Brandon LaFell on a slant instead. This was great because it meant there was no film of that flea flicker anywhere. If we ran it in the playoffs, it would be a total surprise. The other trick play Belichick wanted to install came to him one Saturday as he was getting his fix of the college game. On that night, he got home just in time to see the Crimson Tide head into overtime. During their first possession in the extra session, Nick Saban, Belichick's friend and fellow football savant, called for a pass to what appeared to be the left tackle, who was actually a legally eligible tight end in an unbalanced formation. Alabama flexed its right tackle to the left of the defense, lining him up inside two receivers while putting the tight end where the left tackle normally stands. On the snap, the tackle, lined up way outside like a receiver, just stepped back away from the line, and the tight end, lined up inside like a blocker, ran down the seam and caught the ball for a huge gain. It was devilishly clever and all perfectly legit because if you look closely, Alabama had the requisite seven men on the line, just not in their normal spots. The next day, Belichick breathlessly recounted the play to his offensive coaches and told them he wanted to start working on it right away. After the quick-paced scrimmage, Belichick and the team headed over to the movie complex by the stadium to watch the soon-to-be-released American Sniper. The movie is loosely based on the life of Chris Kyle, a Navy SEAL who was awarded the Silver Star and four Bronze Stars, among other medals. The movie was a classic Belichick choice because it highlights teamwork, sacrifice, and overcoming obstacles. Kyle is the star of his unit, an expert marksman who can hit a target almost a mile away. But he doesn't act like a hotshot. He's just one member of a team in which everyone has to do his job for the whole unit to succeed. The movie affected us all. It would have been easy to focus on Kyle's impressive record as a sniper or the horrific and sad fact that after returning to Texas, he was murdered by a former Marine he was trying to help. But as we all strolled back to the facility afterward in the dark, all I heard was players talking about how Kyle's unit kept working together, even through chaos and life-threatening danger. The movie stayed in my mind the whole weekend, even as I watched the Ravens pull away from the Steelers in the wild card game. By the end of the third quarter, I announced to Millie and our sons that we were going to be game planning for Baltimore. I knew what kind of a challenge we faced over the next week, and I must have been eager to get started because that night my internal alarm clock went off at the ungodly hour of 3:45 a.m. There was no time to waste. Kickoff was less than a week away. Here's a behind-the-scenes look at everything that happened next as we prepared to play the Ravens. Sunday, 6 days before kickoff. Most of the players don't report until tomorrow, but the staff spends all of today preparing game plans and scouting reports. It's a short week, as our game is on Saturday, but that doesn't change our to-do list. The Ravens-Steelers wildcard game is already loaded into the video system, and the staff gets to work preparing for Belichick to call a meeting to map out the rest of the week. Right now, though, he's busy familiarizing himself with every detail of the Ravens' different units, planning out our preparation and forming a vision of the game in his head. When the staff comes together later in the afternoon, he will offer a few of his initial thoughts and then see how they jibe with the approach his coordinators have mapped out. But first, Belichick will conduct a meeting that has become the signature of his game planning regimen, a private skull session with Brady. The backup quarterbacks are also in the room, but it's really just two of the all-time greats riffing and brainstorming about the challenges and opportunities in the upcoming game. Belichick begins by sharing his own handcrafted report on the Ravens' defensive back seven. In exquisite detail, he goes over the players showing tape to accentuate his points as he discusses how to attack each of them and the unit as a whole. This is not a game plan meeting. It's a scouting meeting, maybe the most exclusive in sports. Not even Josh McDaniels, the coordinator, is invited. Most coordinators are protective of their players and want to control who talks to them or whispers in their ear. But in New England, that's not an issue. Everyone knows that Belichick's vision and preparation have quite a track record, and that whatever he has to say will only benefit the players, the team, and the coordinator, for that matter. When the players leave the session, they probably know more about the Baltimore secondary than most of the people on the Ravens staff. This private session includes Belichick's unique approach to game planning. He starts at the end. 6 days before facing Baltimore, he and his field general already have synchronized their brains and their focus. And this week, that means moving right past first down, where most game plans begin, and to an increased emphasis on third downs. After his one-on-one with Brady, Belichick studies tape while running on the treadmill. At 5 o'clock, Belichick, still a little damp from his workout, is already seated at the head of the table as his coaches wander in for the full staff meeting. As soon as everyone fills his usual seat, he begins. The first topic is inactives for the game. Belichick says that five players will not dress for sure and that the status of a few others will need to be determined during the week. It's mundane but relevant because with limited time to prepare, coaches don't want to waste practice reps on guys who won't see the field. Peeking at his typed notes, Belichick appears to be in a relatively good mood as he goes over what he wants to spend time on. Dressed in his signature frumpy workout gear and sipping a protein shake, the first thing he tells McDaniels is not to take starting tight end Rob Gronkowski off the field. Never. Not once. Make them defend him on every play, he says. The plan for Gronk is clear. The question Belichick has is which tight end he wants lining up alongside of him. Based on the talk around the table, the coaches prefer the reliable Michael Humanamanui, Human, to his buddies. He isn't the fastest or most athletic guy in the league, but he understands the system, which gives the coaches comfort, and his hands are outstanding. Most important, Brady trusts him. That's no small thing. If Tom doesn't trust you, he won't throw to you. For any veteran quarterback, trust is everything. For Brady, it is the only thing, and you don't earn it easily. Just being on the team won't cut it. Heck, just making the Pro Bowl won't cut it either. You must prove that you have made the offense a part of you, made it second nature, knowing where to be at all times. Brian Timms was a receiver who made our team 1 year after an excellent preseason. He was raw, a track star in college, but he was hardworking and athletic. It wasn't enough. He never quite got it, not to Brady's satisfaction anyway, so he never saw the field, let alone the ball. This week, our other choice at backup tight end is Tim Wright, a converted wide receiver who isn't much of a blocker. We have plenty of talented receivers. What we need is help with the Ravens' ferocious pass rush. Belichick, in full command, listens intently to the talk in the room, then makes the call. Even on major decisions, he's quick and decisive and leaves no room for lingering debate or doubt. When there's an issue with the game plan, the staff talks it over. Belichick listens, then rules, and that's that. Against the Ravens' edge rusher, an extra blocker makes the most sense. Who man it is. Finished with the tight ends, Belichick changes subjects abruptly. Turning to Scott O'Brien, he says he wants special teams to go right at Baltimore's long snapper Patrick Scales. That's right. In the first meeting of the biggest week of the year, the long snapper is the topic of conversation. Don't get me wrong. For me, a former college long snapper, I think it's a perfectly reasonable subject. And it's pretty standard fare for a special team savant such as Belichick. But everyone thinks it's a little random until Belichick starts talking about how pressuring the poor guy just might pay dividends. Belichick, a failed college lineman turned long snapper, is speaking from experience. But believe it or not, he actually knows something about Scales because he and O'Brien keep an updated database of every long snapper in the league just in case we need a new one. In fact, Belichick's pro scouting department often brings in snappers for evaluation because, not surprisingly, the Patriots treat the long snapper with the same level of importance as a punter or kicker. Belichick and O'Brien must have uncovered something about Scales that tells them he can be rattled. Not surprisingly, Belichick isn't sharing that something with anyone. Defensively, Belichick is concerned about the Ravens' cut blocks, primarily how his hulking defensive tackle, Vince Wilfork, will handle the borderline dirty technique. He wonders out loud how we can simulate this in practice, duplicating the Ravens' offensive tempo and tactics without injuring any of our players. For starters, we'll need to spend extra time with our practice players to make sure they imitate the Ravens' technique precisely, cutting a defender off near the knees, knocking him to the ground, and thus out of the play. And that means a special meeting after the full team meeting. Nothing is left to chance. We need these practice players to give us an accurate but safe look. Belichick talks to defensive coaches and Dave DiGuglielmo, our offensive line coach, to make sure everyone is on the same page. This is a mainstay of the Belichick process. Practice execution becomes game day reality. Unless we can make our practice cut blocks convincing, we won't be prepared to defend the Ravens' go-to running play. Once he checks off all the items on his list, we plan a week's worth of practice, as Belichick's son Steve, an assistant, transcribes it all on a grease board. As everyone expected, especially those who read my memo, third and short and third down in the red zone garner their own five-minute periods. Now, 5 minutes might not sound like much time to spend on something deemed so important. Let me assure you that in the football world, it's a lifetime. Team preparation is a never-ending math problem, with practice time limited by restrictions imposed by the players' union and the needs of a recovering human body. With so little time and so much to do, a coach has to find the right balance. There are 5,500 waking minutes, give or take a few, between now and kickoff, and Belichick doesn't plan to waste a single one. A team can run maybe 8 plays in 5 minutes. If we're on our game, that should be plenty. Monday, 5 days before kickoff. The decor of the Patriots' inner sanctum is constantly evolving and expanding. New framed action photos are added to the walls after each victory. The hallway leading to the team meeting room is decorated with portraits of the Patriot of the Week an honor handpicked by Belichick and awarded after wins to the player who demonstrates selfless team-first behavior. These tributes hang throughout the season and are in this hallway for a reason. They are the last thing the players pass as they head to the team meeting room each day. Belichick welcomes the players back with the same spiel he laid out for the coaches the previous night. Baltimore is a confident team that has won in Foxborough before. They will not be intimidated. Forget the win-loss record. Forget September and October games. What matters is how they are playing now, and they are playing well. What is most interesting is what he doesn't mention. Any of the previous games the two teams have played against each other. He stays in the moment, focusing on the task that lies ahead. Who cares what happened in the past? What's important, and you can hear it in Belichick's voice, is that he has great respect for this opponent. When he praises the Ravens' skill and toughness, he means it. In the regular season, Belichick has a habit of building up an opponent early in the week before systematically pointing out its myriad inadequacies as the days march on and kickoff approaches. The Ravens don't need any puffing up. Their success speaks for itself. The longest workday of the week, because it's when the game plan is installed and first run through, begins with the longest team meeting of the week because of all there is to download. Like most team meetings, this one is not even 5 minutes old when Belichick brings up the importance of the kicking game. Again, special teams means something different to Belichick. To him, they set the physical and emotional tone of the team and the pace of our preparation. When Belichick mentions special teams so early in the meeting, what he's saying is, we will focus on every detail, no matter how small or insignificant, because all of it matters, and any of it can lead to victory. The Ravens lead the NFL in hidden yards, yards that don't make the stat sheet but have an impact on the game. The Patriots are so thorough that we even focus on things you can't see. Stuff like a gunner on the punt team fighting through three blocks to down the ball at the one instead of letting it bounce into the end zone for a touchback. It won't show up on the stat sheet, but that guy just saved the Ravens 19 yards in a game that will be determined by inches, hidden yards. Similarly, the Ravens are the best net punting team in the AFC, which means more often than not, they control field position. They also lead the league in kickoff returns. Belichick warns that the Ravens are aggressive on the road and love trick plays in the kicking game, and then he tells the team what he told O'Brien the day before. We have to attack the long snapper. Next, Belichick puts on his weatherman suit and directs the team to expect extreme cold, the slick heavy ball that comes with it, and the extra care in handling the football that will be required. Turning to the section of the room where the defense is congregated, Belichick says the Ravens are under center almost 75% of the time and use a fullback more than any team in the NFL. Stopping the run will be key. He warns that they also like to call gadget plays and went for it on fourth down 18 times during the season. Belichick has great respect for Gary Kubiak, the Ravens' offensive coordinator, and mentions the naked bootlegs that are a signature of his offense. Most important, when the Ravens need to make a play, in Belichickian terms, a gotta-have-it play, he expects them to try to get the ball to tight end Owen Daniels or wide receiver Steve Smith. Belichick is so certain about Daniels' key role in the Ravens' attack that he will speak his name more than that of anyone on his own roster this week. Belichick then addresses his quarterbacks, who are sitting in the middle of the front row like star students. His first point to them will become his primary message of the week. We must stand up to their defensive front. We need to win this game in the trenches. Our offensive line cannot be pushed around. Surprisingly, we are not overly concerned about Baltimore's outside pass rushers, Terrell Suggs and Elvis Dumervil, each of whom can get around the corner in a flash. Brady generally deals well with that type of rusher, getting rid of the ball quickly or stepping up into the pocket as defenders race past. More problematic is the Ravens' inside rush, spearheaded by Tim Jernigan, Haloti Ngata, and Brandon Williams. If they can push our guards back, it will prevent Brady from stepping up. If he is trapped in the pocket, the Ravens can then tee off on him, and Brady, like any quarterback, is far less effective when he's taking a beating and fearing for his life. Suggs always plays his best against us. He's quick to let everyone know how much he hates us and never calls Brady by his name, instead referring to him as that good-looking fellow from up north. Brady won't stay that way for long, though, if we don't play well up front. Before each unit is set off to be with its coaches and coordinators, Belichick closes the meeting by reading a few things the Ravens said after the Steelers game, including how much they're looking forward to coming to Foxborough. The Steelers are the Ravens' main rival, but the Patriots are definitely a close second. Suggs, we all know the matchup the NFL wants to see. New England-Seattle. We'll see if we can disrupt some people's plans. Part of Belichick's game prep this week is to avoid overcomplicating things for the players. It's his job to decipher the avalanche of information that will flow through our staff over the next 5 days. As for the team, he wants them to focus on things such as special teams, converting third downs, covering Owen Daniels, protecting Brady, and practicing hard. So even his motivational approach, bullet board quotes from the opponent, is the same thing you might see or hear in a high school locker room. It's familiar and effective, so why change it? We're not trying to reinvent the wheel this week. We're just trying to beat Baltimore. Belichick ends the meeting by saying that the word out of Baltimore is that we don't want to face the Ravens. Obviously, we need to prove them wrong. That means having our best week of practice, starting in a few hours. Monday practice. 4.5 days before kickoff. The practice conditions are much like the game will be, cold and getting colder. The field is frozen, the footing is not sound, but the team is used to navigating lousy weather. As the team strolls out into the elements, wide receiver Brandon LaFell is the only player not able to practice. He's been nursing a bad toe, but should be ready for game day. This might be the most relevant fact of the week. In a violent game that is often dictated by injuries, we are completely healthy. The team works hard. With pads on, the drills are physical, but they also serve as a moment of continuing education. My memo predicted that tackling will be the key this week, and we practiced it accordingly. In football, proper pad level, knees bent, ready to strike, whether blocking or getting off a block, is everything. Broken down to its simplest terms, football is a game of leverage, and when pad level is too high, players lose that leverage. When pad level is at the correct height, though, the leverage it allows gives a player control at the point of contact. It might seem as if good pad level would be the price of entry in the NFL. Not so. Pad level is a fundamental that requires constant reemphasis and recalibration of muscle memory. The problem is that league rules governing practice permit 1 day of contact in pads a week, so most teams end up not reinforcing it as often as they should. Golfers work every club in their bag every day. Football teams should work every part of their game each day as well. The winning ones do. We will emphasize pad level today and will continue to do so every day. Brady is throwing well and our receivers are catching the frozen balls without any trouble. During 7-on-7 passing drills, Belichick tasks the equipment men with waving tennis rackets to simulate the hands of defensive linemen trying to bat down balls. Brady hates this drill. It annoys him to no end, but it's a necessary evil. Led by Baltimore defensive tackle Haloti Ngata, the Ravens have knocked down 17 passes this season. The most crucial drill of the day, cut block avoidance, also seems to be going well. Chandler Jones, our starting defensive end, who missed a significant portion of the season with a hip problem, is moving effortlessly around the low blocks. If the Ravens decide to start clearly declining Eugene Monroe at left tackle, the matchup will favor us. Another of our key players seems healed too, starting corner Brandon Browner. He's a tone setter. He gets called for too many penalties and lacks speed, but more important for this time of year, his toughness is infectious. Our offensive line looks outstanding too, especially tackles Sebastian Vollmer and Nate Solder. Just as we hoped, our scout team defense cannot penetrate our interior line, and Brady is able to step up in the pocket and cleanly deliver the ball downfield. With a good first day under our belt, I joined Belichick to watch the last part of practice, the one called opportunity period, in which development of our youngest and taxi squad players continues, even this late in the season. Only one of the guys working out in front of us will suit up on Saturday, but Belichick won't let them off easy regardless. He may be preparing for next Saturday, but that doesn't mean he can't prepare for next season. And the one guy who may get called on is in many ways the most critical player outside of Tom Brady, backup quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo. Most teams don't even consider this contingency. In fact, as the season progresses, most teams increasingly give all meaningful practice reps to their starters. That's what the Colts always did with Peyton Manning. When a TV announcer asked their offensive coordinator about it, he said if Manning ever went down, they were fucked, and we don't practice fucked. An injury to a starting quarterback in the playoffs is a disaster in its own right, but it is compounded if the importance of the game means the backup has not gotten the practice reps he might normally get and surely needs. The opportunity period ensures that Garoppolo will be ready. Maybe not Tom Brady ready, but more than ready enough. After practice, the players sit through a brief review session and a meal. I have seen many organizations try to save money at mealtime, dishing out less than the best quality or selection. That is not the case in New England. The Patriots cafeteria is impressive. The minute the players enter the building, the blenders start whirling, cranking out protein shakes, and a hot meal awaits. The cafeteria sends a positive message to the players the same way companies such as Apple and Google pamper their employees with plush modern campuses. Some teams talk about being first class. The Patriots are. When the players head back to their meeting rooms to watch tape or to one of the sleep rooms Belichick had installed at the facility so that players can stay rested, the coaching staff sits down to rewatch practice. At the head of the table with remote in hand, Belichick admits that the practice field conditions are a problem. As much as he'd rather not give in to the elements in any way, he sees no choice. Tomorrow we will be on the turf inside Gillette Stadium. The practice review session is a glimpse into how the game might go, and Belichick operates in this meeting as he does on the sideline during a game, asking questions, making suggestions, letting the coaches know what is acceptable and what is not. The only difference? No headsets. Never raising his voice, he makes a point and lets the film continue to play. Just as with the tight end decision, there is no gray area. No one is confused, and by the end, no one isn't 100% certain of his assignment. We start, as always, with the kicking game. Coach O'Brien gives the calls for the returns and explains his thinking around each one. As we watch the units go through their paces, Belichick pays close attention not only to make sure the main team is performing as they should, but to be certain the scout team is giving us a good look as well. As we watch the defense practice, their first and 10 calls, Belichick tells coordinator Matt Patricia to make sure we attack the quarterback from the get-go. Kubiak always comes out throwing against us, Belichick says. The session takes an hour and a half, and Belichick makes notes throughout. That will come in handy tomorrow morning at the next team meeting when he'll use clips of the prior day's practice as a teaching tool. Once the film is over, Belichick reminds the coaches that ball security and third downs are critical and urges them to keep the tempo high in practice. The meeting ends and the coaches head back to their offices to prepare for tomorrow. Most won't head home until well after midnight. Tuesday, 4 days before kickoff. As the game approaches, the mood in the building never wavers. From one week to the next, the Patriots maintain the same demeanor. This is the case because Belichick never wavers either, always more concerned about preparation than about the magnitude of the game. He understands, of course, that the playoffs are not like other games, but he doesn't show it, not in his behavior or routine. Instead, he continually reminds his assistants not to change their methods or show a different look. If the players sense we are tense, they will be tense, he reminds them. It's an approach that soon will be tested to the extreme. At the 8 a.m. meeting today, Belichick begins by complimenting the players for the previous day's effort. He lets them bask in the moment for about 10 whole seconds, then it's right back to work. Belichick shows clips of what Ravens quarterback Joe Flacco can do when he gets too much time on first down. As the video plays one chunk big yardage play after another, Belichick's omniscient voiceover fills the room. We must be aggressive on first down and get him to play fast, he says. The video shifts to short yardage plays, and once again, Belichick reminds us that the determining factor will be our ability to stay on the field on third and short while getting them off the field in the same situation. The messages this morning are no different, but the presentation is. There's an edge to his voice now. Look at this moron. Guy can't even make a tackle and get off the field, he says in a sarcastic, biting tone. Who the moron is hardly matters. He can be any of the zillion of players who fail at some point to perform up to Belichick's standards. The players watch and listen as the video jumps to a montage of